From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with one of the survivors of this month's storm on Mount Everest that took the lives of 8 climbers. John Krakauer was one of 2 climbers in his party that survived. He had reached the summit and was descending the mountain when the storm hit. He was there on assignment for Outside Magazine, for which he often writes about high-risk adventure. Also, TV critic David Bianculli previews Walter Cronkite Remembers, a 2-hour special on CBS tonight. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The House has narrowly defeated an attempt to block a vote on the minimum wage. Some Republicans sought to prevent the vote, saying it would be an unfunded mandate. The bill still faces an uncertain future. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Ohio Republican Rob Portman raised the procedural motion to effectively kill the minimum wage increase, saying that the House rule against unfunded mandates should be upheld. House Majority Leader Dick Armey agreed.
Once again, we are contemplating a course of action where Washington gets to feel good about its generosity while others bear the cost. Once again, we get to feign compassion by bleeding our hearts with other people's money.
Democrats called it a hypocritical and dilatory tactic to block the minimum wage vote. They noted that Republicans have voted to waive the unfunded mandate rule 3 times in the past 3 months on bills they supported. Supporters of the 90-cent minimum wage increase still face a potential killer amendment to exempt some small businesses from having to pay the minimum wage or overtime. I'm Peter Kenyon at the Capitol.
The FBI has moved portable power generators near the Freeman Ranch to begin preparations for a possible cutoff of electric power. The anti-government group in Montana is in a 2-month standoff with federal agents. The Justice Department says no decision has been made to turn off the power. A Colorado state senator who had tried to mediate the standoff between both sides angrily left the ranch yesterday. Senator Charles Duke suggested that more talks with the Freeman won't work and the FBI should be more aggressive in trying to end the standoff. He also said there are only a few people inside the farmhouse who believe in the Freeman cause. The rest are criminals trying to escape prosecution. A group of people have been arrested for smuggling automatic rifles into the country. Deputy Attorney General Jamie Gorelick outlined the sting.
We have arrested 7 people for importing machine guns and automatic weapons into the United States from China. We have seized approximately 2,000 AK-47s. This is a joint investigation by Customs and ATF with the active involvement of the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Francisco.
The seizure is being called the largest ever of smuggled automatic weapons in U.S. history. Published reports say some of those arrested worked for Chinese arms companies. The head of the largest mutual fund in the country has quit his job. Jeff Vinnick is leaving Fidelity's Magellan Fund amid criticism of his work. Vinnick says he's leaving and going to form his own investment company. He's been criticized for poor returns at Magellan and for making positive comments on companies at the same time his fund was selling those very stocks. Magellan says Vinnick will be replaced by Robert Stansky, who's been with Fidelity for 13 years. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down nearly 19 points at 5,759. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. The nation's largest toy retailer, Toys R Us, is being accused by the Federal Trade Commission of inflating toy prices. An administrative law judge will hear this case later this year. But right now, Toys R Us is running newspaper ads promoting big clearance sales with some items marked down 50%. A spokeswoman for the toy company says the ads are not related to the FTC's action. Sales at Toys R Us have slumped recently because of competition from discounters like Kmart and Walmart. Earlier this year, Toys R Us announced it would close 25 stores around the world and consolidate some operations. South Korean authorities say a North Korean pilot defected today by flying his MiG-19 jet to a military base south of Seoul. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Seoul.
The North Korean pilot flew his Soviet-built MiG-19 across the border, and South Korean Air Force jets scrambled to intercept it moments later. U.S. forces in Korea say that the defecting pilot indicated that he had no hostile intentions and pointed towards Seoul. The defection triggered the first air raid warnings in the capital in 13 years. Earlier in the day, South Korea said several gunboats from North Korea intruded into the South's territorial waters. In the last month, the North has repeatedly violated the 43-year-old armistice with a series of small forays across the DMZ that have been seen as carefully calculated maneuvers to get the armistice scrapped. The North would prefer a peace treaty signed with Washington, but Washington says no deal without Seoul. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
Philippines President Fidel Ramos granted amnesty to military rebels who launched several coup attempts against his predecessor, Corazon Aquino. The amnesty is expected to be approved by the Philippine Congress. Mutinous soldiers staged at least six coup attempts against Aquino, claiming her government was corrupt and incompetent. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, John Krakauer, is one of the climbers who survived the storm on Mount Everest that took the lives of eight climbers earlier this month. That was the most fatalities in any one incident on the world's highest mountain. The guide from Krakauer's party, Rob Hall, was one of the dead. This was Krakauer's first time on Everest, but he's an experienced climber who has written about the danger and exhilaration of the sport in his book Eiger Dreams and in articles for Outside Magazine. His latest book, the bestseller Into the Wild, raises many unsettling questions about high-risk adventure. It chronicles the story of a young man who went into the Alaskan wilderness and didn't make it out alive. Krakauer returned home to Seattle earlier this week. I asked him to explain why he was climbing Everest.
Officially, I was sent there on assignment by Outside Magazine to write about this phenomenon of guided Everest ascents, where people pay $65,000 to be guided to the top of the highest mountain in the world. That was the official reason. The idea of the magazine. They came up with it and approached me with it. But, I mean, I wouldn't have done it if I really didn't want to climb Mount Everest myself. I mean, that was the real reason I went. I had the opportunity to climb it, an opportunity I wouldn't have had if I hadn't been on assignment, and I leapt at the chance.
Which party were you with?
I was with a New Zealand group called Adventure Consultants. It was led by Rob Hall, a very, very experienced Himalayan climber and guide. This was his fifth ascent of Everest, more than any other non-Sherpa. So it was his group. This expedition was probably, you know, he was the class of the commercial outfits. He was looked up to by all the other guides. When there was a problem, people would go to his tent to sort it out and seek his advice. It's a shock that he died. It shocked a lot of people.
How many other people in your party died?
Four people in of the six people who summited in our party, four of them died. The fifth was severely frostbitten, another one of the guides, and I was the only one who got off without any injury.
Why? I mean, what, did you know
me
more? Yeah, why you?
I don't know this. I mean, this is something that's haunted me since it happened. I mean, I would like to say that, you know, I was more experienced than the other clients or smarter or something, but I think when it comes down to it, I was just lucky. I've gone over it hundreds of times in my mind. I mean, there's some things I had in my favor, but the people who died, I mean, Rob Hall, much stronger climber than I am, another guide named Andy Harris. So I can't tell you. I mean, it's one of those things. Some people lived and some people died is a mystery that I think will trouble me for some time to come.
John, what were the first signs that you saw that a storm was coming?
It was when I reached the summit or shortly thereafter. You have to remember that all this is happening, you know, at 28, 29,000 feet. You're using bottled oxygen, but that brings the altitude effectively to maybe 27,000 feet. So you're hypoxic. Your brain is oxygen starved. And the effect of that is, it's impossible to think clearly at that altitude. The whole thing seems like we were underwater. I mean, it was sort of dreamy and drugged, and in retrospect, things that should have seemed obvious at the time just didn't hit. And I remember getting to the summit and turning around and seeing clouds rising out of the valley. Since you're up higher than anything else, you're above most of the storm clouds. We were above the storm clouds. There's a lot of blue sky. It wasn't until the clouds rose to the level of the summit and engulfed us that we realized, oh, the weather's turning bad. I mean, if we looked down and we're thinking clearly, we could have seen it. But it wasn't until all of a sudden the clouds are over us, they've enveloped the mountain, it's a whiteout, it's starting to snow, that people began to realize, oh, this perfect day. And it started out as a perfect day, perfect conditions, perfect weather. That's when we began to realize, oh, we better get down fast.
And where were you and what time was it when you had this realization?
This was, again, I reached the summit about 1 o'clock. There were about 30 people, maybe a little less than that, climbing that day that set out from the camp at the South Col at 26,000 feet. We started climbing at 11:30 at night, so for the first 5-6 hours we're climbing in darkness. A moon rose over Makalu. It was beautiful. There was enough light from the half moon so we could turn off our headlamps and climb just by the light of the moon. Got to the summit about 1 in the afternoon. I was the second person. I was up in the front about 1 in the afternoon, and that's when the first clouds started moving in. I remember on the way down, I tagged the summit, turned around. I was running out of oxygen, so I was in a hurry. And almost the whole group I passed over the next hour, they were coming up. So we were all sort of bunched together. You know, it was high fives along the summit ridge, congratulating each other. There was no sense that anything was going wrong or was about to turn ugly. And then I moved off by myself. I started moving down. I had the experience to climb by myself, so I didn't wait for the rest of the party. I just started heading down, so I was one of the first people down. And I didn't see the group again until we got back down to our camp at the South Col.
So because you were ahead of everybody else, you managed to be ahead of the storm also?
Well, the storm caught me. I mean, the storm started. It didn't start violently. It was just this, you know, snow, clouds moved in. Climbers call it a whiteout, where all you can see is cloud. It's really hard to make out any features. But, you know, I've been in 1,000 storms like that, and all experienced climbers have. And as I got lower and lower in the mountain, the winds picked up until, by 3, 4, 5 in the afternoon, certainly. By 4, they were hurricane-force winds, just roaring, sounding like a Boeing 747, strong enough to knock you off your feet. I worried that there was so much snow being deposited by the wind that I worried about avalanches. And this is a bitter cold wind, 100 below wind chill, so that any exposed skin, your cheeks, anything freezes very, very fast. And that alarmed me. I mean, I was taking it very seriously by that point, trying not to make a mistake. You know, if your hood falls off, blows off, if it is not buttoned correctly, you're gonna freeze all the skin on your face. So you've got to be really, really careful. And I was. I made it down to just above the camp and paused over an icy section. At that point, I was caught by one of our guides, Andy Harris of New Zealand, who was in bad shape. He was sort of desperate and rushing down, and he passed me. And I saw him walk within 50 feet of the tents, and then the whiteout closed in. I didn't see him. I assumed he was at the tent and that he'd gone to bed. And the next morning, I realized that he never showed up at the tents and went out to look for him at 6 in the morning and spent an hour looking for him. I saw some crampon marks in the ice heading over the 4,000-foot Lhotse face, and I can only assume that he, in the storm and in his exhaustion, instead of taking a left turn for the tents, he kept going straight and walked right off the face. His body was never found.
So when the storm started getting really bad, how did you manage to keep climbing down Mount Everest in spite of these hurricane wind forces and a whiteout?
That's where I think my experience came in. I mean, it's every second you're telling yourself, keep your act together, keep it together. Because if you know, it's not terribly difficult ground, but if you trip or you slip, you're going to fall a long ways. And it's just a matter of concentrating all the time. You know what's at stake. You don't really have any choice. You just have to keep going, you know, keep concentrating. And it's really hard. I mean, with this oxygen, deprivation. I'd run out of oxygen on the summit ridge and then gotten another bottle. But during that half hour or so of that oxygen, I think I suffered some real, I lost a lot of brain cells. And for the rest of the descent, I remember thinking my brain isn't working. I remember it was being like in this weird trippy dream where I remember thinking that I was wearing this green cardigan and I was really warm and I mean, all these strange cartoonish thoughts. And on top of that, I had the presence of mind to say, you're in trouble, concentrate, you know, just, this is serious. And I had the presence of mind to do that, but it was really hard. I mean, I've never climbed at altitude before. I'd never been above 17,000 feet. So this high altitude stuff, this hypoxia was a real challenge for me. And it took a lot of effort to keep it together.
And you never lost your bearings? You always knew where you were?
Another thing I'd done on the way up, and this again was from experience, is that the South Col, this sort of saddle where the tents were at our high camp, is an area about the size of two football fields, and it's really kind of complicated and rocky and icy. And I'd studied it probably 10 or 20 times on the way up, telling myself, okay, memorize this. If there's a storm on the way down, you got to know where to go. If you go over there, you're going to fall off the Lhotse face. If you go over there, you're going to fall into Tibet down the Kangshung face. So I made a real effort, and I'm not sure others did, to sort of memorize the terrain and figure out what I was going to do if I got down after dark or in a storm. And I think that helped save me.
So when you got down to the camp, was the storm really bad at the camp?
Oh, yeah. It was... You know, even in the camp with all your clothes on and your sleeping bag in a tent, I feared for my life. I mean, the tents they're being threatened to, they're being battered. You think they're going to blow apart. You're very cold. You've run out of oxygen. And it's not just, the oxygen also plays a huge part in keeping you warm. The physiology of, I mean, you need oxygen to keep warm. So when the gas turns off and the oxygen turns off, your hands get cold, your feet get cold. So even at camp, it was chaos. You couldn't talk from one tent to the other. No one knew who'd gotten down and who hadn't. Climbers were coming in the middle of the night, just finding a tent and piling into it. There were still, I think, about 10 or 12 climbers out as of midnight. They'd gotten down to the area of the tents, but they couldn't find the tents. And they were in desperate shape, just barely hanging on to their lives. When one of the guides, Neil Biedelman, happened to, a little after midnight, catch a glimpse of the, you know, like a 15-second glimpse of where the tents were and dash for the tents with anyone who could walk. There were still five people left out there who were in such bad shape. They were just lying on the ice, comatose, unable to help themselves. And another guide, a Russian named Anatoly Bukharev, went back and heroically dragged three of them back. Two he couldn't bring back, and one of those, Yasko Namba, died that night. The other, Beck Weathers, rescue party found him in the morning, and in sort of an act of triage, this rescue party found both Beck and this Japanese woman, and they were both barely alive, but they assumed they were going to die, and they were better off just leaving them there. So this rescue party decided to leave these two people there, and amazingly, 6 or 8 hours later, Beck Weathers kind of woke up and roused himself and walked into camp, you know, almost blind. He'd lost a mitten. One hand was, you know, completely frozen. This is sort of an amazing tale, how this guy saved himself.
It was kind of like he came back from the dead.
Oh, yeah. He was given up for dead, literally. And then once he even got to camp, we all assumed he was going to die. He was put in a tent, sort of, and tried to be made comfortable. And I remember radioing down saying, you know, with two of our guides dead and the others really frostbitten, I sort of became the guide by default and had to get the others down. And I remember radioing saying, Beck's in bad shape. I can't get him down. I think he's going to die. I'm sure he's going to die. What do I do? I was sort of near tears. And they said, there's nothing you can do. Don't worry about it. And I brought our group down. Some other people, some rescuers, another climbing group came up from below to try to help Beck, and they shot him full of this steroid, Decadron, and it roused him, and they incredibly brought him down. When I saw him later that day, after getting down to a lower camp, Beck was walking into camp under his own power, sort of blind, but being guided by someone, but still, it's an amazing survival tale. His will to live was inspiring. I mean, this guy refused to die.
Did you talk to him?
Yeah, I talked to him at some length. I haven't asked him how he feels about being discovered early that first morning after the climb and being, you know,
passed
sacrifice.
Over.
Yeah. I mean to do that.
Did he talk to you about how it felt when he realized he was going to live?
He just talked about, at some point he said, you know, if I don't do something now, somewhere deep in his reptilian brain, he realized, you know, I've got to rouse myself. I've maybe got a few hours left to live. If I don't do something, I'm going to die. And he had a vision problem anyway. He had eye surgery, corrective eye surgery, and for some reason the low pressure at altitude made him lose his vision at altitude, which is why he was unable to do the climb in the first place. So he could barely see. He'd spent out all night. He's lost a glove. He's severely frostbitten. His face is all swollen and black. And he started walking. He's just sort of, at one point he said he made out some blue hump, some weird blue form that turned out to be a tent, and he walked into camp and surprised everybody.
My guest is John Krakauer. He's a journalist who writes about the outdoors. He writes for Outside Magazine. He has a best-selling book called Into the Wild. And he was one of the people climbing Mount Everest when the storm hit earlier this month, and he's one of the people who survived. John, let's take a short break, and we'll talk
sure.
a little bit more. This is Fresh Air. Back with John Krakauer. He's a journalist who writes about the outdoors, and he was one of the people climbing Mount Everest when the storm hit earlier this month. He's one of the people who survived. John, you said that when two of the guides died, that you became like the de facto leader of the group at the camp. What did that mean? What responsibilities did that mean you had to take on?
It just means... Someone had to. Most of our group was experienced, but they're clients. They've hired a guide because they lack experience or the desire to sort of make decisions, and so it meant that I was bringing up the rear, sort of keeping telling people if they didn't have their goggles on to put them on because they're going to get snow blind. To you know, someone their hands are too frozen to buckle their harness. Doing that, I mean, it wasn't a big deal. But it just meant I became responsible, sort of looking after the flock for the next day, carrying some stuff. I mean, it wasn't a huge responsibility, and I welcomed it because it took my mind off some of the more troubling events of the previous days. You know, it was only for the next two or three days, and I was doing fine. I came out of, as I say, I was physically in better shape than anyone in our group and almost anyone on the mountain by some stroke of luck. And so I was able to perform these minimal duties, and I thought I was doing fine. And then when I finally, there was a Beck Weathers and a Taiwanese climber named Mac Lu Gao were in such bad shape that the Nepalese government sent in a helicopter and did a world record altitude rescue at about 20,000 feet. And I remember I loaded Beck and Makalu on the helicopter and I headed down through the ice fall and finally got to base camp. And I thought I was doing fine, but when I got down, I mean, I just lost it. I just broke down and just, you know, cried and sobbed and sort of the strain of the preceding days caught up to me. And I sort of haven't been the same since.
Yeah. What did you do to try to get the others down who were still descending from the peak?
Well, they could, except for Beck, who needed great assistance from guides Todd Burleson and Pete Athens, who selflessly, I mean, they were guiding another group, and they left their own plans and came up to rescue Beck. But aside from him, everyone in our group could get down under their own power, so all I had to do was sort of bring up the rear and kind of usher people along and help them a little bit. But, you know, our group was able to descend and on their own power. Some of them were pretty slow. So,
when you got back to base camp and realized that some of the other people in your party were not going to make it back and that they were really trapped in the storm and weren't as capable as you were in getting down, what's the, I don't know if etiquette's the right word here, but what you must have felt like, oh, well, there must be something I could try to do to help them, and yet there was probably nothing that you could possibly do. I mean, what goes through your mind about the responsibility toward the others who weren't making it?
Oh, I've gone through a lot of guilt, and I haven't resolved it yet. And that, you know, the night after we got back to our tents, if I'd really had my act together, if any of us had, you know, we could have been out there trying to rescue Yasuko Namba, this Japanese woman, and Beck, and who were at the call, and Yasuko died there. I mean, you know, she was two or three hundred yards away from camp when she died, and so you ask yourself, why didn't I, upon realizing she wasn't there, go out and search for her, search harder for her? I mean, you have to deal with that a lot. I have to deal with that. There are things we could have done and didn't do. I mean, at the time, we were so messed up. You know, it was all I could do to get into my tent and just try to hang on myself. But in retrospect, you ask yourself, gee, maybe I could have saved her life.
But on the other hand, a couple of the leaders of the climb stayed behind to try to save people and died doing it.
Right. Yeah. Rob Hall, I'm sure, died because he stayed behind with a climber from Seattle, Doug Hansen, sort of collapsed on the summit ridge, and Rob stayed behind with him. I remember there was a radio call at 4:30 from base camp to Rob in which they suggested, you know, Doug's a goner. You should leave him and go. And Rob refused to do that. I mean, as a professional guide, he couldn't. As a person, he couldn't. And it ended up costing him his life. Rob held on throughout that night and into the next night. He was talking by radio much of that time. And we had considerable hope that he would make it down. We kept urging him, you know, come down, start down, just start down. And he would imply that he would. He said, okay, I'm packing up. And then an hour later, he'd get on the radio and we realized he hadn't left at all. He'd frostbitten his hands badly. In the upper part of the mountain, there's some technical sections, some ropes you have to descend, and he felt he couldn't safely descend those. So he decided to stay in the hope that a rescue team could come up to get him. But that was, that was crazy. No one could get up. And sometime in the second night, the radio communications ended, and we assume that's when he died.
John Krakauer will be writing about the storm on Mount Everest for Outside Magazine. He'll tell us more about his own experience during the storm on the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with John Krakauer, one of the survivors of the storm on Mount Everest that killed 8 climbers. He'll tell us about being in base camp, in radio contact with guide Rob Hall, as Hall died, trapped in the storm. And TV critic David Bianculli previews Walter Cronkite Remembers. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with John Krakauer, one of two people in his party who survived the storm on Mount Everest earlier this month. Krakauer had reached the summit and was descending the mountain when the storm hit. He made it back to base camp. The leader of his party, Rob Hall, stayed behind to be with climber Doug Hansen, who had collapsed on the summit ridge. Krakauer and others at base camp were in radio contact with Hall as he lay stranded in the storm with no chance of being rescued. When you knew that he might die and that he was probably in too bad shape to descend, what kinds of things would you say to him? I mean, you are able to be in radio contact with him, but he's out of reach to you.
I didn't really participate much in those conversations. Most of the conversations were between his base camp and Rob, and they were urging him to just hang on, and actually on three occasions he was patched through to his wife in New Zealand, who talked to him. The people at base camp were trying to get all his friends, his wife, people who cared about him to talk to him and make him feel better and encourage him to go down. So it was heartbreaking to hear, you know, his final conversation was with his wife, who was 8 months pregnant in New Zealand. And Rob was amazing. He was, you know, he was trying to put on a good face, trying to sound happy and healthy, and sort of lying to his wife about how dire his circumstances were, and trying to be positive to her and joking with his Kiwi sense of humor. It was really heartbreaking.
You were listening into that conversation?
Right. I mean, we all, since we were in his team, we had the same frequency, so we would, you know, we could hear these conversations.
What was his wife saying? Was she also trying to keep on a good face and not let on how worried she was?
She was incredibly, you know, she was saying, oh, Rob, I'm directing all my positive energy at you, you know, I'm sure you're going to be okay. She was being incredibly upbeat, but that wasn't enough in the end. I mean, it was, you know, this 100-mile-an-hour winds blowing across the summit of Everest. Rob's he's at the south summit, just below the summit, in a little protected snow hole. But he's so isolated. If you're doing him in safety, there's a lot of very exposed, very dangerous ground. And the longer he stayed there and the weaker he became, you know, the more and more difficult it was going to be. There's some Sherpas who are very loyal to him over the years. They've worked for him. They respect him. They really love him. They tried repeatedly to get up to save him, but the storm was just too great. And they feel terrible. They you know, when word got to them that Rob died, I remember handing the radio to Ang Dorje, our lead Sherpa, and he just broke down and cried there at 26,000 feet. I mean, it was... The loss of Rob Hall devastated a lot of people and has made a lot of people think. I mean, Rob, you know, was the guy who was more than anyone responsible for this guiding Everest. He'd done it a lot. He'd gotten more people to the top than anybody. And he was conservative. He was a really good guide. And if this could happen to him and his clients, you know, it could happen to anybody. I think it's raised a lot of questions about this whole business of guiding people up Everest, whether I think it'll continue to be done. I suspect this tragedy will... If it has any effect, it'll make more people than ever be interested in climbing Everest. But it's raised some questions. Right after the tragedy, a number of other guys on the hill were saying they weren't going to do it anymore. Now, maybe they'll change their mind once they get back to the States. The money's good. There are reasons that it's a good gig, a good job. But at the time, they were ready to bail.
I guess for someone like Rob Hall, there were really no options. I mean, do you think that if he had tried to make it down the mountain, that because of his frostbitten hands and because of the storm, he never would have made it?
I think he might have. I think that in retrospect, that's what he should have done. I mean, even if he'd fallen, and he might have, better to fall than to stay up there and die. I mean, I don't know. I asked myself, well, what would I have done? And I like to think I would have headed down no matter what. I mean, as long as you're moving, you have a chance to stay up there. I mean, you know, no one could reach him. But he made a decision. I mean, again, he's without oxygen. He's run out of oxygen, you know, 24 hours earlier. He's not thinking as clearly as he might. He just kept saying, I'll be all right. Just send the boys, meaning the Sherpas, send the boys up with a couple thermoses of tea and I'll be fine. I mean, that's what he kept saying when we'd say, Rob, man, head down. Just start, pack up, go down now. And he would just say, no, can't do it, frostbitten hands. So, you know, that's part of the problem. Rob had really good judgment, and he would lecture us earlier in the trip about the dangers of Everest and how the need to turn around when the weather looks bad, even if you're close to the summit, and how you shouldn't be foolish. And he sort of broke a lot of his own rules, and a lot of it probably has to do with being oxygen starved. I mean, that's all I can think.
Is it exhaustion sometimes too? Is there just like an impulse to just like lie down and go to sleep when you're that exhausted and oxygen deprived?
Sure, there is that impulse, and I think that's what sort of did Scott Fisher in, the other really experienced, he's an American guy who died lower on the mountain. Scott actually was about halfway down when he just sort of packed it in and sat down in the snow and muttered something about send a helicopter, which anyone in the right mind would know is impossible at 28,000 feet, 27,000 feet, and he just gave up. But I mean, these guys are so experienced, and they've been through a lot of close scrapes, and they know how to resist that impulse. I mean, you don't survive that many Himalayan climbs without sort of being able to resist that impulse and just keep going when your body wants to shut down. I mean, that's something these guys have been used to. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure why Scott Fisher died. I think he was having a bad day. I think he'd climbed the mountain 2 years earlier without oxygen, which is an amazing feat. And I think that might have, this time around, he probably wasn't taking it as seriously as he should have. He was using oxygen. He'd been running himself ragged over the previous days with his clients, you know, ushering them up and down the ice fall when they were feeling bad. He didn't have the rest he needed. So I think Scott just wasn't taking it as seriously as he should have and just run out of gas, because he wasn't with any clients. He was just at the end of the line coming down. And I mean, Scott was an incredibly strong climber. He was an amazing athlete. And there's a lot of people here who just can't believe he's dead or that he died in the way that he did, because those of us who knew him, were his strength was legendary.
John, who are the Sherpas?
The Sherpas, it's an ethnic group that lives in a very small pocket of Nepal, a place called the Solo Khumbu, a few valleys, you know, an area the size of a small eastern county. They're not very many of them. They live in this one isolated area, but they're amazingly strong, amazingly able at altitude. They're good climbers. Their whole culture in a certain sense revolves around Western climbers coming to climb these high peaks. The Sherpas who become guides or who work for these expeditions are, you know, they're the heroes of their villages. It's a big deal that they're the sort of, they become relatively wealthy, famous. Their culture and the Western climbing culture are completely tied up with each other and inseparable. And the Sherpas depend a lot on expeditions. I mean, for their, you know, Nepal is one of the, I think it's the fourth poorest country in the world. Terrible health problems, terrible poverty, and the climbing, the expeditions has allowed the Sherpa people to sort of rise above that poverty. And they're really concerned, like the fact that Rob Hall died and Scott Fisher died. I mean, Rob Hall's guide company is probably going to fold. They were depressed for many reasons, but one of which is that the loss of work. I mean, Rob Hall won't be coming back and hiring the 15 or 20 Sherpa that he hires every year, and that's a significant blow to the local economy.
Did you go to the memorial service?
There was one at base camp that we held. There's going to be others coming up. So, yeah, at base camp we had this impromptu memorial for the five climbers from our expeditions who died, and it was kind of a depressing, and I don't know, I had trouble with it. I mean, a lot of people stood up there and said, you know, Scott would have wanted us to carry on and let's not get depressed and, you know, think about the good things in life. It just seemed like, you know, I don't know. I didn't buy it. I just thought, I got up and talked about Doug Hansen as this single parent with two kids now who don't have a father, and just sort of said, man, there's a lot more at stake here than just your own life. I mean, I was, you know, sort of addressing the climbers who had yet to go up, and there are some. There are some around the mountain now, and saying, think about Doug before you act rashly.
So I hadn't thought of that. So you thought you had a responsibility to the people who were first going to take the risk, and you're trying to talk some of them out of it.
Well, I don't know what I was trying to do. I was just depressed, and this sort of forced bonhomie, this forced good cheer about, you know, Scott would want us to carry on and think about, you know, to life and you know, no guts, no glory, or I don't know, this sort of, this good cheer. I just wasn't feeling cheerful. I was feeling severely depressed and maybe inflicted my depression on others. It didn't go over well. I mean, what I said, just sort of people kind of murmured and went on to the next guy. So, I don't know.
My guest is John Krakauer. He survived the storm that killed 8 people this month on Mount Everest. He was there on assignment for Outside Magazine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with John Krakauer. He's written extensively about high-risk adventure. He's one of the climbers who survived the storm on Mount Everest. Now, the party that you were climbing with was a commercially sponsored group where you pay, you said, I think, what, $60,000 or something like that for the benefit of climbing with an experienced guide up Mount Everest. What's the controversy now over these commercial tours?
Well, the question is, are there people on the mountain who shouldn't be? I mean, you know, if you pay your $65,000, you know, they'll accept you pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
And does this result in unsafe situations where people who aren't qualified to be on the mountain are on the mountain? And it's a tough question because, I mean, I don't care how much money you pay, you're not going to get up Everest unless you're qualified. It's incredibly hard. I mean, I can't begin to convey how hard it is. It's aside from, you know, you're it's a 2-month expedition. You're at or above 17,500 feet for about 6 weeks. At that altitude, your body, you know, it does very strange things. Cut stone heal. You're coughing all the time. The air's so dry. You're not metabolizing food well because to do that you need oxygen. So your body, you just lose a lot of weight. Your body starts consuming itself. I lost 25 pounds, a lot of that muscle mass. You're going up and down the mountain to acclimatize, sort of wearing yourself out the whole time. When finally you're acclimatized and ready to do the summit push, there's 3 really hard days of climbing just to get to the high camp. So for 3 days, you're going all day, you know, full out, wearing yourself out just to get in a position to climb to the summit. Before you do that summit push, I didn't sleep for 3 nights before. I think I ate in three or 4 days. I ate about, I think I had a bag of peanut M&Ms, and that's about it. So when you go for the summit, you're already extremely stressed. It's physically harder than anything I've ever done. You have to really call on all your reserves, all your determination, all your resolve. So, I mean, people, anyone who got to the summit deserved to get there. No one hauled them up. I mean, these were people who were qualified to do it. The difference is they're qualified as clients. A lot or most of the people on the mountain who were paying that money, they need a guide to sort of make decisions for them, to sort of keep an eye on them. And on a peak the size of Everest, above 8,000 meters, when things go wrong, I mean, the guides couldn't even save their own lives, let alone look after their clients. So these clients have a false sense of security. I mean, on lower mountains, you know, the guide can look after the clients, and the clients used to relying on the guide, used to the guide saving their bacon. And on Everest, that can't happen. I mean, when things go wrong, it's just impossible. There's just, you know, at 8,000 meters, air that thin, without oxygen, a guide just can't look after his clients as well as he should. And I'm not sure all the clients realized that. I think there was some shock and dismay when they realized that to a great extent they were on their own up there.
We've done several interviews, you and I, and it seems every time we talk, our conversation ends with reflections on high-risk adventure. And I would really like to hear what's going through your mind about that now. And I just want to say, too, that you're coming off of writing a book about somebody, a young man who went into the Alaskan wild and died there, never came out. So you chronicled his story, thought a lot about risk, and now you've just come back from Mount Everest in which, you know, what, 8 people died, and you're one of the ones who survived. So what are you thinking now about how much risk is worth taking for the adventure of mountain climbing or any other outdoor sport?
Right now, my head's in a really bad place, and I just think, I met the kids of Doug Hansen at the airport. I brought back his belongings from Nepal.
These are the kids who, he was a single father, and now he's dead, right, and his kids have no parents.
Right. And, you know, facing them, facing some of the other families of the deceased, risk, to look in their eyes, there's no way risk is worth it. I mean, if you survive and things go well, it's great. There are definitely benefits from taking chances. But right now, it just seems crazy and selfish and, you know, can't be condoned. But having said that, I mean, you know, I look at myself and I feel like sort of one of these, powerless to change. I'm compelled to take risk in the same way that Chris McCandless was the subject of this book. I mean, that book, I explore risk and the impulse to take it and to test yourself. And I don't really understand the impulse, but I understand it enough to know when it's there, it's sort of irresistible. For some people, it just defines them. It's an integral part of their life. They can't. It's just something I have to do. And I think I might be one of those people. I like to think that as I've gotten older, I've gotten smarter and the risk is more sort of, you know, in my head or illusory, or I get the same charge without actually taking as much risk. But this Everest thing is really shaking me up. I mean, this is the first trip I've done where anyone died and I sort of had to look at death at close range. And it's, I don't know. I'll be interested to see what effect it has on me. I don't think I'll quit climbing. I can tell you I don't think I'll ever go back to an 8,000-meter peak, to a big Himalayan peak. There's just too much misery, too much death, not enough pleasure. I mean, the pleasures I get of climbing aren't all risk. You know, a lot of it is just the pleasure of being in the mountains, of moving on steep ground. I mean, there's a lot of joy in climbing normally. And this Everest trip, the ratio of joy to misery was just way too low, and I don't know. I mean, I don't know what I'll do, how this will change me. It's way too soon. I just haven't come to grips with much of what happened there. So it'll be interesting to see whether I keep taking chances that I've taken in the past.
You've said in the past that I think when you got married, you promised to give up real high risk climbing, and that when you started doing climbing again, it nearly ruined your marriage. What was it like when you came home?
It was great. It was great to see Linda, my wife. I mean, she sort of knows me better maybe than I know myself, and has come to accept this risk-taking side of me. And she also had this sort of naive faith that I would be all right. I mean, throughout all the, you know, when reports started coming back that people were dying and there was a disaster in the making, for whatever reason, she just had herself convinced that I was okay. And she's all right with it. I think if I said I was going to go back to Mount Everest next year, there would be some problems. I have no plans to do that.
You were on Everest on assignment for Outside Magazine. Have you started writing the piece yet?
Haven't, and it's going to be hard to write. I've dabbled with. I have a lot of research to do still. A lot of phone calls just to try to iron out some details. You know what happened. Talking to other people who are on the trip. So I don't know. Writing is going to be difficult. I mean, I'm really close to the story. I'm really bent about it. I mean, I don't think you can write a piece under those conditions. So somehow I've got to shake myself out of this funk, get over this fever, and come at it from a different angle.
What are you doing to try to shake yourself out of it? Or are you just trying to sit still and give everything time?
I mean, so really, since I got back, I mean, I was okay for about a day. I sort of had this euphoria where I, I just walked down on the beach near my house with my wife and kind of just kicked back, drank a lot. And then since then, I sort of, this fever came on and I've just been kind of depressed and spent yesterday in bed. I mean, I'm really, I mean, I guess I've just got to give it a couple days and try to get it out of my system. But I, you know, I haven't been myself. I've been kind of acting weird. And I don't know. I'll try. If I don't get out of it in a couple of days, I'll try something different.
Have you been dreaming about the climb?
Yeah, I've had a lot of, almost every night I have nightmares about it involving, you know, sometimes just kind of thing, waking up out of breath, gasping, and I keep seeing Andy Harris wandering off into the mists. I mean, I'm troubled by this. This is something. I'm usually pretty well grounded, pretty centered. And this whole experience has really knocked my equilibrium off. So, you know, I don't have a clue yet how to get it back.
Well, John, I want to thank you a lot for taking some time out to share some of your thoughts with us. We appreciate it very much. And I wish you kind of good health and a kind of good recovery from what I know is a really horrible experience for you. So thank you very much.
Thanks. Thanks, Terry.
John Krakauer will write about the storm on Mount Everest for Outside Magazine. He writes about the dangers of high-risk adventure in his bestseller, Into the Wild. Coming up, a preview of a Walter Cronkite retrospective. This is Fresh Air. Tonight, CBS devotes 2 hours of prime time to one of its most famous former employees, Walter Cronkite. The program is called Walter Cronkite Remembers, and TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
After Walter Cronkite retired from the CBS Evening News in 1981, the network basically ignored him for a very long time. Part of it was strategic. After all, their job back then was to build the reputation of his replacement, Dan Rather. So for a while, the man known as Uncle Walter, the man once voted the most trusted man in America, had to step out of the picture. But long after that was accomplished, Walter Cronkite remained an untapped resource at CBS. By the 90s, Cronkite was doing almost all his work for cable TV on the Discovery Channel. Even this new CBS special, Walter Cronkite Remembers, is getting better treatment on the Discovery Channel. Next year, Discovery will show it in expanded form as an 8-part series. So I guess we should be grateful that CBS has gotten around to Cronkite before the special would have had to be titled, Remember Walter Cronkite? And there's no question, Uncle Walter deserves the airtime to sit back and tell his old war stories. In his case, the wars include Vietnam and World War II. And his other stories include sitting at the anchor desk for the two most famous news events in the history of television. One was the assassination and funeral of John F. Kennedy in 1963, the other was the first moon landing in 1969. Walter Cronkite Remembers devotes a decent chunk of its airtime to those two stories, but not in the way you might expect. What makes this documentary entertaining as well as informative is that Cronkite isn't above making fun of himself, or giving others the opportunity to do the same. Wally Schirra, the astronaut who was Cronkite's on-air sidekick during the Apollo 11 coverage, remembers what it was like as Apollo 11 got closer and closer to the moon. We hear Wally, then we hear Walter, then we hear Wally again.
What can we say? What are you going to say when these men land on the moon?
Oh, well, I've considered that quite seriously.
I see, Walter. Well, thank you.
3, 2, 1, 0.
So we went on and had liftoff.
Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
And then subsequent to liftoff is a quiet time where they're in orbit getting ready to burn to go on their lunar trajectory.
Hello there, Earthling.
I said, Walter, this really perplexes me. Here's a world-class journalist, and you're still procrastinating on what you're going to say when these men are on the moon. I need to, I'll be with you, and I'd like to get a feel for it.
Oh, I'll have something very good to say, Walter. No, don't worry about that. No problem at all.
Pound and a half. 30 seconds forward.
Finally, we're approaching lunar landing, and we're off camera, and we're looking at each other, and I said, Walter, what are you going to say?
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground.
Oh, boy.
Thank you.
You're looking good here.
What?
Wait, we're going to be busy for a minute.
Golly, gee, wow. The world-class journalist has spoken.
When that vehicle landed on the moon, I was speechless. I really couldn't say a thing.
In CBS News history, Cronkite does not exist in a vacuum. Edward R. Murrow and colleagues paved the way on both radio and television, and Dan Rather and others have carried on the tradition, or at least tried, at a time when ratings and budgets matter a lot more than they used to. In a way, Walter Cronkite Remembers is the central chapter in a capsule history of the evolution of TV news. But it's more than that because this special also is personal. Cronkite dismisses JFK conspiracy theories as Oliver Stone junk and tells a very funny story about the time his daughter Kathy, in 1969, asked for $5 from her dad to attend a concert with her friends. He said okay, thinking she was catching a local show at the Met. The concert, he found out a day or two later, was called Woodstock. In the 60s, when even a famous anchorman had to deal with the generation gap, that's the way it was.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Alan Tu, with Kathy Wolf and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Roberta Shurak directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.